Hi, I'm Lance Russworm from Kitchener, and you're listening to 102.7 CKMS Radio Waterloo.ca.
Community connections. CKMS. Local sounds, thoughts, passions, and success. Celebrate local. Your neighbor's got a story to tell. CKMS.
Happy Holiday Monday, Waterloo Region. You're listening to CKMS Community Connections for the 3rd of August, 2026. My name is Bob Johnson. In the studio with me is Lance Russworm, who's going to be performing for us today. Hello, Lance.
Hello.
What have you got for us today?
What do you want? I play all kinds of stuff. I listen to all kinds of stuff, but...
Known as a country musician?
Yeah, I played country mostly all of my life.
Okay.
My dad, of course, was a country musician. Mm. I grew up with my parents who were both country musicians. So, yeah, pretty much from when I was born.
Right.
And the first music I ever heard in my life was Hank Williams, so... Wonder if I should do a Hank Williams tune.
Come by it honestly, then. Hank Williams would be good.
Okay. I'm a rolling stone, all alone and lost, for a life of sin I have paid the cost. When I pass by, all the people say, just another guy on the lost highway. Just a deck of cards and a jug of wine and a woman's lies make a life like mine. The day we met, I went astray. I started rolling down that lost highway. I was just a lad, only 22. Neither good nor bad, just a kid like you. And now I'm lost, too late to pray. Lord, I've paid the price on the lost highway. Now, boys, don't start your rambling round on this road of sin, or you're sorrow bound. Take my advice, or you'll curse the day you started rolling down that lost highway. You started rolling down that lost highway.
Lance Russworm in the studio live.
That's an old, authentic one from before I was born, probably 1950-ish.
Okay. But you've been playing, I'm going to say, all your life.
Not really. Actually, you know, my parents were musicians when I was really little. You know, my first music was listening to country shows that they'd be doing, and I'd be the brat running around in the aisles because they couldn't control me because they were up on stage when I was like 3 years old. You hear all these stories about musicians that couldn't afford a decent instrument, and they made a shoebox into a guitar and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I was running around tripping over Gibsons and Martin guitars in the house because my parents were musicians, and I wasn't in the slightest interested in music as a career. I was into art a bit, about that later. But I never really picked up the guitar till I was like 14. I even watched the famous Beatles on Ed Sullivan in 1964. I was like 11 years old when that came on. And every musician I know who was my age, they all said they saw that and they ran out and bought a guitar and learned rock and roll and started, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I watched it, and, you know, Dad and I, that's interesting. Those guys have long hair. Did they scream while they sang and stuff? But I had no desire to get a guitar. It turned out it was the old story. When I got into high school, at 14, somebody, you know, pointed out to me that girls like guitar players. So all of a sudden it was, Dad, what was that chord you were showing me again? That was the height of the folk era.
Okay.
And I was really into folk when I started out. Even my parents were. Usually country and folk didn't mix that much back then, but my parents actually went out to some of the coffee houses in town and stuff. And
okay.
I remember going to backstage and meeting Ian Tyson at Laurier University with Dad and, you know, various people like that. And, of course, I remember Dad telling me about this new young songwriter from Toronto named Gordy Lightfoot. They called him Gordy back then. He didn't get respect yet. He wasn't yet famous, but he was making it as a songwriter, and there was a lot of buzz.
Right.
So I kind of remember all that stuff. We'd have all the TV shows on, like Let's Sing Out was a folk program.
Uh-huh.
I think that was a show they broadcast from a different university campus every week because that was the hotbed of folk music.
Right.
I remember hearing Joni Anderson from Saskatoon, who we now know as Joni Mitchell, you know, and she was still playing those.
Getting all the people before they were famous.
Yeah, yeah.
You toured with your dad for a while.
Yeah, eventually, like, okay, I was listening to this folk music when I learned guitar, but then also when I hit high school, I also started listening to, like, Jimi Hendrix and Steppenwolf and Cream. They were, like, the equivalent of heavy metal in those days.
Uh-huh.
So I got into that and, you know, got into rock and roll and big amps and big guitars, and I tried to learn. I wanted to, you know, I wanted to be a lead rock and roll guitar player, but I never really was a lead player. You know, I learned a lot of folky finger-picking stuff and all mm-hmm. that. I learned it off Gordon Lightfoot's first albums is where I learned most of my guitar. I dropped out of school when I was 16 in 1971. Dad needed a guitar player in his band, and he asked if I'd play it. I don't know country or anything. I hope my friends don't see me playing it. But basically, I turned 18 the same day they lowered the drinking age to 18.
Ah.
It later went to 19, but yeah, it was 18 for a while. So I started playing in my dad's band every weekend. I don't think I had a weekend off for 15 years.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, as a young guy, you know, I had to give up all the parties on weekends and stuff because I'd be playing in some little
right.
bar.
You'd be traveling all over southern Ontario?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, anywhere within about 100 miles of here. It was all weekend work mostly. We'd play the odd full week. Sometimes Dad would take holidays from work and we'd play somewhere, which was cool.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a lot of fun, and I did, my guitar playing tightened up a lot. I was very shy. I wouldn't sing at first. I remember Dad talked me into singing, and the first time it was actually in a bar in Elora. It's still there on top of the hill. Yeah, I remember the blood going to my head when I sang my first song on stage. You know, you can feel that hot rush, and then when the song ended, they applauded. This is not too bad, you know. But I was still pretty shy. I didn't really, you know, I'd do a couple songs a set. But there was 15 years of it.
Yeah.
I'm the only person of my generation that never saw Saturday Night Live because I was always out playing
right.
somewhere on Saturday night. So.
Mm-hmm. Didn't get any formal musical education. You just picked this up by absorption?
No formal education. And honestly, most practicing musicians have a lot less than people think. A lot of them, none formal education. You know, most of them learn it off friends and stuff. Today, though, if somebody came to me as a kid and said, or my kid's learning guitar, what advice? I would say, take the formal education. It can't hurt, but you don't need it. You know, there was a friend of Dad's, for example, who was a really good violin player. He was like a symphony guy. And
this was Mike Slawenwhite?
Yes, mm-hmm. Mike Slawenwhite. He played with the KW Symphony Orchestra, but he would also moonlight. There was more money playing country music, doing fiddle with them, you know. But guys like him, though, he would, when the Ice Capade show would come to town, they'd hire musicians, and they'd find ones who could read music properly, because they'd just throw the sheet music in front of you, and you could do symphony music perfectly. And for that, you need the music reading skills.
Right.
So I remember seeing the Ice Age or the Ice Capades once, and I wonder if Mike was playing on it when I was a kid.
Could have been. You know, yeah.
But other than that, most musicians, like the Beatles, I think they're all self. I don't think any of them had any, you know. My dad actually, surprisingly, took piano lessons when he was young.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
So he could read and write music. Back in the 50s when I was really little, when he'd send songs out to publishing companies to try and place them. Today it's all, you send demo CDs and stuff, but back then it was sheet music.
Right.
Dad could write all his stuff up as lead sheets. And,
oh, really?
You know, it's handy.
Okay.
Gordon Lightfoot, too, was, you know, he went to that music school in L.A. and learned proper,
okay,
you know, scoring and sheet music and all that. It helps. Like, I've got a pretty good ear, so I can hear, you know, am I trying to figure out a song? I can hear a chord and I can think, oh, he dropped that one note there to change it from a major into a minor. Like, I can sort of hear stuff like,
okay,
that. But because I don't really know the structure and the theory, I have to, like, try every possible chord to find the right one.
Right.
Whereas somebody that knows would know, well, it's got to be this chord because of the rules of, you know, music is mathematical and structured,
yeah, yeah,
ultimately.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Your dad, Lynn Rustlerum, was, well, he's recorded. He's got an album out from, the 1960s, the Hummingbirds album?
Yeah, actually, that's the mid-70s.
Mid-70s.
Yeah, he had a lot of songs of his recorded by other people. He would always be making tapes down in the basement, demo tapes. After lead sheets, eventually everybody started getting tape recorders in the late 50s. So I grew up with tape recorders at home, which people didn't have in those days. You know, tape recorders were a real novelty.
Yeah, I guess that's a bit easier to do than to write up sheet music.
Yeah, yeah. There was little, you get little tiny reels of tape that were like 2.5, 3 inches and
mm-hmm.
little envelopes and send them out. So Dad was always taking a bunch of them in the mail, sending them to Nashville and all over.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally he'd get some interest and would sell some songs. And
okay.
A bunch of fairly well-known artists did his work.
You have an example of that?
Yeah, the one I remember particularly well, Dad did some collaborating with an artist named Hank Thompson. He's not as well known today, especially in Canada, but in the U.S. in the 50s, he was a really big artist. I think he first came around 49 or 50. He had a Western swing band, which was a very sophisticated, large
mm-hmm.
band. He had a big hit called The Wild Side of Life, I think 1950.
Okay, I don't know that one.
It was about a guy who's stuck at home with the kids while his wife is out making the honky-tonks and, you know,
mm-hmm.
just generally doing bad stuff. And anyway, that was a huge hit. And then Kitty Wells, who was one of the first country female superstars, did an answer to that called It Wasn't God Who Made Honky Tonk Angel. She gave the female side of the song.
Right.
So in the early 50s, every country band, if there was a male and a female, they'd do the two songs and do a duet of
okay.
them and all that.
Okay.
Yeah, she'd be explaining that the reason she's out in the honky-tonks is because he was cheating all over, too, and all that, you know. So this is country music. It's actually the genre called honky-tonk. That actually is a type of country music, you know, as opposed to, say, Western swing or bluegrass or something. And honky-tonk is the stuff that it became mainstream country in my youth. You know, that is the stuff about cheating and drinking and truck driving and all that, you know.
Right.
So,
which is what you consider the classic country music.
Yes.
That's where country music came from. So your dad hooked up with Hank Thompson somehow.
Yeah, so I remember he was thrilled because that was the first time he hooked up with a large act. And I know he co-wrote us. No, Hank Thompson bought a song off him outright, and people today say, how could he do that? You know, give up the royalties and everything. But I think
give
he
up the royalties,
got,
give up the copyright, give
yeah,
up.
Yeah, he got $500 for it in 1958 or something. That was a lot of money. He was working in a factory, raising a family on one paycheck and, you know, a new house paying for and all that. So he said he took the money. He was quite happy. And Hank Thompson was always a straight dealer with him, too, unlike a lot of people in the music business. But anyway, after that, though, Hank did co-write a couple songs where they'd both get credit. Dad would be the first to admit, actually, Hank would often write most of the song. He'd often use the title, but again, he was scrupulously, you know, honest about it. So if he just used your title, you'd get half the royalties for the song.
Wow.
But none of them were actual hits, but the one I remember was a song called I Cast a Lonesome Shadow, and it came out in 1961. Dad wrote it. He sent it to Hank. Hank liked it had a very sinister, dark feel to it. And Hank said he reminded him of Edgar Allan Poe, the Raven, or something like that, the lyrics. And Hank wrote up a really dark, sinister song. Hank Thompson always liked the song. He put it on a bunch of albums, but it was never a hit. It was, you know, as some writer said in an article that I saw, that it probably too weird for the country artists of the time. And another interesting thing is that everybody's heard of Merle Travis. He's the guy that invented finger picking. You know, that sort of thing. Right. Chet Atkins perfected that. But basically, it's called to this day Travis picking. Even the folk singers admit that, you know, what Gordon Lightfoot does when he's finger picking is Travis picking. Anyway, Merle Travis was in Hank Thompson's band at the time. So I'm thrilled that Merle Travis actually played on this song that my dad wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And when the song came out, we got sent a copy of the 45 in those days. That's how singles were done. And we were so poor, we didn't have a working record player in the house. I think Dad had an old 78 player that couldn't play. So we had to go to somebody else, some friend of Dad's place, to listen to this record. Huh. And I remember Dad was trying to memorize it because Hank had changed it extensively. And,
right,
you know.
Right.
But anyway, it showed up once in a while. It wasn't, you know, Dad would get royalties for it, but not a lot. But it was on several albums. So, I've got several albums. Dad used to collect albums, and I've got some of them. And so the song showed up here and there. But about 15 years ago, maybe,
mm-hmm.
you recall that,
yeah.
I think.
I think late 1990s, 1999 or so.
Oh, was that long ago?
Yeah.
Anyway, a techno-pop band from Britain called Depeche Mode, one of their members named Martin L. Gore, took a cast alone some shadow. Where he found this obscure 1961 country hit, I don't know, but he put it on a... And all of a sudden, Dad had a song done by Depeche Mode. He got some pretty wild royalties for it, too, yeah. You know, out of the blue. Yeah, I think it was you, Bob.
Yeah.
Just disclaimer here, Bob is my brother-in-law. So
yes.
We do.
This is a family show.
Statement of fact, yeah. Anyway, I think it was you that found that or something.
Uh-huh.
And brought it to our attention that this was, it was kind of a cool thing. And Dad had no idea who Depeche Mode was, and he got in touch with Hank Thompson, who was still alive. They would talk to each other once in a while when went to the States. He'd often look them up. And Hank Thompson got a kick out of that, too. They weren't quite sure what to make out of techno-pop music,
yeah.
But they didn't mind the extra royalties coming in either. Anyway, yeah, now I believe all Hank Thompson's song catalog was bought up by Sony. So
okay.
That's where the song rights lie now. Song that Dad sold outright, it actually was recorded by Ray Price and Hank Thompson.
Okay.
And Dad always thought, I wonder if I could get the rights back to it somehow. And I thought, with dealing with Sony, the huge conglomerate, I don't think there's much chance of that happening. So anyway, that's the story. Oh, and mm-hmm. I Cast a Lonesome Shadow went on to other stuff. Then we started discovering that it became popular with all these rockabilly bands. I guess they liked the darkness of it or something.
Could be.
And anyway, so a lot of rockabilly bands did it. And then a couple of years ago, it was used by an Americana artist named Sonny Crockett. They used it on the TV show American Gods. So again, this song really has legs for an obscure, weird country song from 1961 or something. So,
mm-hmm. And you've recorded it yourself?
Yeah, I've recorded two versions of it, and I'm going to do an acoustic version now, which will be like neither of them.
Always good to have another cover of Lynn Russell and Hank Thompson's song, I Cast a Lonesome Shadow.
Every evening when the sun goes down, I sit here in my room. The lamplight streaming o'er me projects my lonely gloom. My counterpart in agony mocks each tear that falls, and I cast a lonesome shadow on these lonely, lonely walls. He's always by my side at night, no matter where I go. He lurks out in the darkness or in the neon's glow. He follows me across the steps and up and down the hall, and I cast a lonesome shadow on these lonely, lonely walls. I sit and watch the candle and the flicker of the flame. My writhing shadow twists and turns as though it is in pain. I'm trying to escape the memory my heart recalls, and I cast a lonesome shadow on these lonely, lonely walls. The image of a love I lost and all the things I planned are as empty as the bottle that I hold in my hand. My soul is buried in the depths of love and life's pitfalls, and I cast a lonesome shadow on these lonely, lonely walls. I cast a lonesome shadow on these lonely, lonely walls.
Lance Russellrum, live in the studio on CKMS Community Connections. And that turned out to be not famous exactly, but popular.
Yeah, well, the song has legs, as I said. Yeah. You know, never got any, you know, over the years, he'd get a little bit of royalties because, you know, he did sell songs to other people back then, too. Well-known country artist Carl Smith did a song of Dad's. There were some bluegrass bands, one called the Lewis Family from the South, did some of Dad's stuff. And, you know, here and there, people would record his stuff. Dad worked extensively with, there was a barn dance show that started out in, CKNX Wingham radio back then. It started in the 30s, and then they became a TV station in Wingham, Ontario. They were like the closest thing Southern Ontario had to the Grand Ole Opry. They'd do it every Saturday night. They'd do shows on the radio, and they'd broadcast them from a different town, you know. So they'd play all these, you know, Wingham and Listowel, all, you know, every these small towns. And that became a pretty big thing for a while. And again, I kind of grew up with those shows because my parents would play on them regularly. It was one of the well-known artists was Earl Haywood, was one of the guys who started the barn dance. I think it started in 1938. Yeah, Grant Haywood, who was Earl's son, he became a well-known rock musician. Mm-hmm. He was with Major Hoople's Boarding House for a while and various other bands around the area here.
Yeah.
And I remember my dad and Earl sitting around and talking about our sons playing that darn rock and roll stuff, you know. And ironically, I got back to my roots when I got older, and so did Grant. You know, he actually became the president of the Barn Dance Society.
Right.
And
the Barn Dance had a big revival in the 1990s.
Yeah, they revived. The Barn Dance shows went, actually, I played on some when I was with my dad's band back in the 70s, but they kind of wound down by the 80s. You know, that kind of stuff was out of fashion. But sometime, you know, they started reviving them. Dad was doing all these shows. He used to have some at Binghamton Park. I was calling them Jamboree reunion shows at the time, but they evolved into, with Earl Haywood's help, they started the Barn Dance shows up again. And again, they became pretty big for quite a few years.
Yeah.
I think when would he have started that? Maybe in the late 80s and all through the 90s. They played the last official Barn Dance show, not last year, the year before.
Okay.
I was on it and I was thrilled because, you know, it was the end of a long line. But they have since done a couple of Barn Dance show revivals at Purple Hill down near London, which is a well-known country venue. So they still revive them once in a while. You know, it's a very small market these days, you know.
Yeah. The few CDs that got released Saturday night at the Barn Dance, volumes 1 through 3.
Yep.
And I have a few of those in our library, which we'll occasionally play.
Yeah.
What we need on our radio station is a dedicated country music show.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that just doesn't get the playtime, the airtime that it needs.
Yeah, country music is, Dad started Sunday night shows in Elmira, in the park downtown, Gore Park, which is where the gazebo is in downtown Elmira. And he started that, it must be 20 years ago now.
Well, at least, yeah.
I'm not even sure. He did it for quite a few years. He started, you know, just a couple guys playing at the gazebo. There was like, there'd be like 10 people out in the audience. What's this? You know, and then it grew year by year until all of a sudden they were getting some serious crowds.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, Dad did that until, well, he passed away in 2016.
And right until the year before that, he was doing these shows. He'd every June, July, and August on Sunday nights, although I think when Dad first started, he wasn't doing June yet. It was just the 2 months originally. But anyway, he'd have a different band every night. And
got to the point where from just a handful of lawn chairs on the park grass there, people were spilling out into the road and blocking traffic. And
They literally took over the road there. Fortunately, the township was behind it, so... One day a cop came along and got out of his car and was standing there with his arms crossed. And I'm going, what's he doing, you know? And I went over and I said, is something happening? He says, no, I just wanted to hear the music. I was just cruising around tonight, you know. So anyway, that went on until, well, Dad passed away in 2016. Before that, he was sick and I started helping him with the shows. And, well, you used to do it before me. He passed away and I took over and we did it right up until COVID. And then we had to shut down, of course, for a couple years. And then after COVID, although it was before COVID was quite over, there was now vaccines and stuff, but we started talking about doing it again. And I said, there's no way we're packing 800 seniors into that little park with COVID going around yet. So I looked for a new park, and we moved to Gibson Park on the edge of Elmira. It's much bigger, much better facility, beautiful washrooms. The old place had Johnny on the spots by comparison. Anyway, it's they're getting quite popular, and I have never actually counted a crowd there. So I'm just guessing. I've got what I think is 800 people, and I'll say that's equivalent to what we had last week. But I'm not sure. I've never actually counted. It might actually only be 600. But I think an average crowd is like 700-800 people these days. And some of the really popular bands, we get 1,100, 1,200 people there. Yeah. And that's a lot of people.
But now you have the space to accommodate them all. Nobody has to sit on the road.
Yeah, the sound's pretty good out there. And the only thing is we're not downtown anymore, so you can't just walk up to the ice cream store and get ice cream and stuff. It's in a park. But every Sunday night after our shows, the McDonald's and Harvey's and all those places on the highway are all quite busy.
Right.
So it's the only place where you can get real traditional country music these days. That's what I grew up on. Mm-hmm. To me, that's real country music. Today, they call it Americana. Yeah. Unfortunately, we're Canadians and have to put up with that name, but it is American music, ultimately, so, you know, that is fair enough. But I don't like the way they've kind of marginalized it, you know, as opposed to, you know, what they call country that they're playing on country stations these days. Right. But, you know, times change.
Yeah. We're here at the beginning of August, so you've got, what, 3 or 4 weeks left?
Next week is Honky Tonk Heart, which are three women who do wonderful harmony, great personalities. They're really quite popular. They're very personable on stage, as well as very good singers, with some really good musicians backing them up. And the week after that is, Naomi Bristow is, I think, the next week. She's very popular. She started as a child star on those barn dance shows I was talking about. She's now in her mid-20s. She's very popular. She bills herself as a yodeling cowgirl, and that's quite an anachronism in this day and age, you know. Yeah. And the thing is, her father actually was a bull rider. She really did grow up with rodeo, so she really does have a cowgirl background.
Really?
She's a wonderful singer, and she performs usually by herself as a single. She's got an amazing voice. She does some of those traditional yodeling songs from the 30s, you know, I Want to Be a Cowboy's Sweetheart by Patsy Montana. That's the one that people always trot out when you want a female yodeling song. Okay. It goes back to the 30s. And she does those, but she also has a great voice for Someday Soon I'll Go With Him. That song, Ian Tyson wrote that. You know, a lot of females do that. So she does a beautiful job in ballads, too. Anyway, she's quite popular.
Okay. And local, too, isn't she?
She's from Beaton, actually. So that's a fair distance away to come.
Okay.
And then, Diana the Cavaliers. And then... Southbound will be the last act.
Right.
Yeah, they've traditionally been our last act of the summer.
Is that on Labor Day or is that?
It's the last Sunday in August.
Okay.
It's not. We
so
never
not
go
Labor
to
Day.
Actual Labor Day.
Okay.
It's whatever the last Sunday in August is. So, yeah, Southbound's more of a mainstream country, George Jones-ish, but they can do some really jazzy, swingy stuff too. But they've had some personnel changes, so we'll see how they are. They're one of the best bands around,
I've heard them in the past. There,
Naomi's really popular, and Diane and the Cavaliers, who's playing the other show, that'll be the second last show, I believe. And anybody who lives around this area knows Diane because she's been around forever.
Right.
And you know, she celebrated her 60th year in country music many years ago.
Right.
But she's still popular as ever, and she's played at everybody's wedding and things like that over the years. So, you know, and she's mainstream country too, you know.
Right. That's taking place at Gibson Park in Elmira.
Yes.
7 p.m. on a Sunday.
Yes. Yeah, we do have a Facebook page for the Elmira Sunday Concerts or something like that. I'm not sure. It has kind of a cumbersome name. That's Dad, not me.
All right. We'll put all that stuff in the show notes. You'll be able to see that at radiowaterloo.ca/CCC.
Okay.
With event notifications and all the rest of that. Something else for us?
Well, I don't know. Would you like another song? Here?
Sure, let's have another song.
Okay, I'll do one of my songs. So I did start writing songs at some point. I've written a few songs. I kind of played on and off, but for the last 20 years or so, I haven't been playing much. I do one of the Elmira shows. I just did last week's show up in Elmira.
Oh.
I've done a couple of barn dance guest shots and stuff like that, but I really haven't had a band in quite a few years now. I'm experimenting more with playing as a single in seniors' homes and things like that. Anyway, I've written some songs over the years. I did a CD about 10 years ago that Dad produced. So this is a song I like to play around here because it's about growing up in Waterloo, called Raise a Glass to the Past. I've been playing on the road. 15 years I've been away, but I took a drive through my hometown today. The place has really changed. Rows of houses fill the fields where we played ball and stole first kisses in the hay. The woods we used to walk are now a plaza and a used car lot. And the haunted house is just a faded patch of ground. And the band shell in the park where we cuddled after dark got torn down like the corner store we hung around. Let's raise a glass to the past. We always knew it wouldn't last, but it scares me how the years slip by so fast. Maybe in my memories, my bygones will live on, but I found out today that it's all gone. I met the first love of my life. Now she's a mother and a wife. We didn't really have too much to say, but I can still recall the thrills of sultry summer nights back then, before the years and tears stole our dreams away. Let's raise a glass to the past. We always knew it wouldn't last, but it scares me how the years slip by so fast. Maybe in my memories, my bygones will live on, but I found out today that it's all gone. And I found out today that it's all gone.
Lance Russlerm, live in the studio. Been writing a lot of songs?
Not a lot. You know, Dad wrote like 700 or something. I can't remember. It was, you know, over the years. he could dash one off on the back of a napkin. You know, I don't know, it's hard for me to get ideas. When I do, I write down notes and stuff, but I've probably only finished about 25 or 30 songs or something over the years.
That's still substantial.
Yeah. It's you know, some of them are pretty nice, too. Yeah. I did put out a CD that I mentioned earlier about 2015, I think we did it. Mm-hmm. Dad produced it. It's got 20 songs on it, which is quite a lot. A CD will hold that comfortably. A lot of people put on less, so I give you your money's worth. it's about a third Dad's songs, about a third my songs, and about a third classics, you know, Hank Williams tunes and things like that. I Cast a Lonesome Shadow is on it,
yeah.
You know, among other things.
But music was never your full-time gig?
No. I've been a commercial artist mostly for my adult life. I specialize in old mechanical things, actually historical scenes too, but old houses, old airplanes, old trains. I've done some prints that are fairly well known around KW, one of the old City Hall in Kitchener. Sold very well some years back at Christmas time.
Mm-hmm.
I worked out of Baden for a while too. I had a studio up there selling art. But I've done a lot of commercial art for airplanes and stuff for a company that does t-shirts and mouse pads and things. A lot of my art is in the Hamilton Warplane Museum in Hamilton.
How'd you get your artwork in there? That seems like an odd place for an art gallery.
Well, it's not an art gallery. They restore World War II airplanes in the Hamilton Warplane Museum. Mm-hmm. And because I'm interested in old cars, old airplanes and things like that, I fell in with people that are into that too. I used to sell my art out in St. Jacobs in a gallery there. And I ran into some guys from Hamilton coming through and they told me to come down and I got interested. I was into old airplanes when I was a kid. Kind of lost it when I got older. Anyway, that kind of rekindled the interest in that. A story, a friend of mine, one of my best friends in public school, we both were the airplane guys, you know, we could identify every World War II airplane and we'd draw them on our notebooks and stuff. Anyway, I lost touch with him around grade 6. He moved out of town, I think, to Toronto. And I kind of drifted into, you know, I became a hippie and anti-war protests and stuff. So I kind of left those old warplanes behind. And, you know, anyway, years later, I met this friend of mine. And turns out he did just the opposite of me. I drifted out of the warplane thing. He joined the military and learned how to fly jets and flew airliners all his life. And he's now retired. And for his hobby, he flies the Lancaster bomber at Hamilton Airport once in a while, among other planes there. So I've been up with him and that a few times. And, you know, anyway, that's how I got it. You know, people like that. Mm-hmm. There's a Harvard Aircraft Association that flies old Harvard trainers from World War II. I've done some work with them, too, some prints that they've sold as fundraisers. Hamilton, we've done the same.
Yeah, you've painted some planes. Not just making images of planes, but you've actually put paint on planes.
Oh, yes, yeah, the Lancaster in Hamilton, which is one of the... There's two currently flying Lancaster bombers in the world. That was the best British bomber of the Second World War. It did the Dam Busters raid and a bunch of really famous raids. Anyway, there's only two of them left in the world, and people don't realize that warbirds are horrendously expensive to keep flying.
I'll bet.
It's like $100,000 to rebuild one engine. The Lancaster has four, and you've got to rebuild them every 1,000 hours in the air. So, you know, that alone is a lot of money, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They take it up and bring it right back down. They've spent thousands of dollars. You know, crew have to swarm over it and check everything. Even though the planes are, you know, date from the 1940s, they're probably in better shape now than they were during the war because they were made by unskilled labor just thrown together to, you know, expected to last a couple of missions and then get shot down. So nobody dreamed they'd be flying half a century or more later.
Okay. You know? And then on there, you've painted nose art.
Yes. Yeah, on the Lancaster. Yeah, they like to change the paint job every year. Oh, that's not the Lancaster.
It's not the Lancaster?
Okay, we'll start with that one. That's a B-25 they have at Hamilton. Okay. It's a pinup girl because that was a popular subject during World War II. I know it's sexist and all that today, but...
I guess that was authentic to the day.
Yeah, during the war, you know, men wanted to show how macho they were. So, yeah, one of the most popular things to paint on the nose of their planes were scantily clad females. And they would have cartoon characters and other stuff, too, but the most well-identified ones are females, you know.
Right.
And a lot of famous artists, there was a guy named Milton Caniff who used to do a comic strip called Steve Canyon.
Okay,
and,
yeah.
He also did another one later on. Anyway, some of these famous artists would do free nose art on bombers. Anyway, Hamilton has a B-25 bomber. It's actually an American plane, but Canadians did use them. They had various paint jobs on it, and they had the pinup art, and I think they got some protests from people protesting that it was a nude female on there. And so they got rid of it, and they changed it to Happy, one of the Seven Dwarfs.
Oh.
So the plane was Happy for many years, and then somebody else took over and decided, no, we got to have the original nose art on it, so they hired me to do it. And I confess, artists don't like to admit this, but I did bow to censorship, and I put a bathing suit on the girl.
Ah.
I actually think it looks better. It looks more 1940s Varga girl-type illustration, so... You know, everybody's, we have school kids going through here. We can't have a naked woman on a plane. So anyway, she's still on there. And I did that quite a few years ago now, maybe 2010. And I used the sign painter's paint. And I'm amazed the paint looks like it was done yesterday. And that plane flies at 200 miles an hour all over North America, you know, through rainstorms and
stuff.
Right,
right.
And anyway, it held up pretty good.
Yeah.
And the other one was the Lancaster. They decided one year to paint teeth on all the engines, like American P-40s. Okay. During the war, they'd have a paint job.
Like shark's teeth.
Yeah, like shark's teeth. So it looked like a shark's mouth under the propeller, and they'd put eyes on it to make it look ferocious to the enemy. Anyway, there was at least one Lancaster in the same squadron as the one from Hamilton that had shark's teeth painted on all four engines. So I did that for, you know, I spent a week, not quite a week, going up because they're like 20 feet in the air. The Lancaster's a big airplane. So I painted all these shark's teeth on it. People liked it, but that year they got the permission to go ahead to fly the Lancaster back to England so it could be with the only other Lancaster in the world. And they decided that when it flies over to England, it must bear its regular paint job. It's named after a certain veteran, Andrew Minarski. And so we had to take the teeth off. It was only on for a few weeks, and they were taken off for its trip to England. I did get a ride in the Lancaster as part of my deal with them. So
okay.
And that's a very expensive ride, and it's pretty cool.
Yeah, loud is what I heard.
Very loud, yeah. You have to scream in people's ear to be heard. Fortunately, my friend was co-pilot that day, so I got to sit up front and wear headphones, and I could actually hear what the pilots were saying to each other.
Okay.
And stuff.
You know? Okay, cool.
But anyway.
The other thing you've done a lot of art for is murals around Southern Ontario.
Yes. Every once in a while, a mural crops up somewhere, and... I always swear, I'm not going to do another one. I'm too old for this crap. And then somebody waves some money at me, and I will go. You were showing a picture there of, I've done several murals up in New Hamburg area.
Mm-hmm.
I did a mural on it started with a mural on the fire hall in New Hamburg. They'd torn down a building next door, and they had a blank wall, and they had a competition for the mural. And I had never done a mural in my life before, but I'd read up on some guys who were using automotive spray guns to paint murals. I use an airbrush for my regular paintings, and airbrushes are basically a miniature version of a spray gun that you paint cars with. So I figured, I'll be able to use an automotive spray gun. So I won the competition for my sketch for the mural in New Hamburg. This was in 93 or 4, I think. And I didn't know it would work, but it did. I found out that using spray paint is really efficient. I only used like 6 or 8 gallons on a mural that's 80 feet long by 20 feet high. Yeah, so that was the start of my murals. And every once in a while, I do another mural. There's one in a print shop up in New Hamburg. There's some at a seniors complex up there. And then a few years ago, I did the biggest job I ever did was the New Hamburg grandstand at the Fall Fair. And the grandstand had been burned down about some years back. They lost it in a fire, so they built a new one out of concrete, but they left recessed areas that I think were like 16 by 24 feet or something, and there was 9 or 10 of them. So they were all separate murals. It was designed to have murals on the wall. And I did that job around 2016. It got kind of put on hold because my dad got sick, and I was helping with him, and he passed away ultimately. So I started one year and finished the next. But anyway, it's still there up on the grandstands in New Hamburg.
Right.
And that's probably the biggest mural job I've done.
Mm-hmm.
I just turned one down recently because this year I'm trying to be retired and enjoy myself. And I actually turned down a mural, which I never would in my youth, but I could use the money, but, you know.
Yeah.
I'd rather be retired sometimes.
And retirement consists of playing music.
Yeah, not necessarily. I've got too many hobbies, you know. I'm into model trains. That's my biggest hobby. Art and music are both hobbies that take over people's lives, and they dedicate their whole life to one or the other, and I feel like I'm spread too thin, you know. I know other people that devote their whole life to it, and I feel kind of guilty, like, gee, I'm not putting enough into the art as an artist would, or not as much into the music as a musician would. I've always wrestled with that, you know, kind of a modern-day Renaissance man that's interested in a lot of things, but you can't be an expert at any of them because you're spread too thin.
Right, you know? Right. Still, it's a nice portfolio, both the art and the music.
Yes, I enjoy it. Once in a while when I get a job where I can blend the two, I love that. Like doing my CD, for example.
Oh.
I did the cover. It's an illustration that I did, a self-portrait of myself. And I also designed the cover, so I did the graphic design, and which I do know how to do that. So blending that with the music, descriptions of the song, so I wrote, you know, I loved it that I could draw, and I was totally consumed with that. You can get really drawn into these projects. You know.
Do you have time for one more song?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. What should I do then? I'm going to go with Bob Dylan.
Ooh, Bob Dylan.
Go back to my folk roots. And this song is maybe overplayed. It was either that or Hallelujah by Leonard Cohen for Canadian stuff, but I'm going to go right back to the beginning. And Bob was there before Leonard was. So it's a song called Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, which is one of the best breakup songs ever written. Ain't no use to sit and wonder why, babe. It don't matter anymore. Ain't no use to sit and wonder why, babe. If you don't know by now, when the rooster crows at the break of dawn, look out your window, babe, and I'll be gone. You're the reason I'm just traveling on. Don't think twice, it's all right. It ain't no use in turning on your light, babe. That light I never knowed. Ain't no use in turning on your light, babe. I'm on the dark side of the road. Still, I wish there was something you would do or say to try to make me change my mind and stay. But you and I never did too much talking anyway. Don't think twice, it's all right. Ain't no use in calling out my name, gal, like you never did before. Ain't no use in calling out my name, gal. I can't hear you anymore. I'm thinking, wandering all the way down the road. I once loved a woman, a child, I'm told. I gave her my heart, but she wanted my soul. Don't think twice, it's all right. Walking down that long and lonesome road, babe, where I'm bound I cannot tell. But goodbye's too good a word, babe, so I'll just say fare thee well. I ain't saying that you treated me unkind. You could have done better, but I don't mind. You just kind of wasted your and my precious time. And don't think twice, it's all right. Don't think twice, it's all right. Don't think twice, it's all right.
Lance Russell, live in the studio on CKMS Community Connections. Somebody once told me that Bob Dylan wrote everything.
Yeah, I think I know what you mean by that, that like he influenced so many other people. There was a part of every other song came out of his stuff. I like to point out that Bob's often considered not the greatest singer around. You know, nobody doubts his songwriting chops, but lately I've been doing Dylan songs, and his phrasing and his songs are pretty sophisticated. They're not just three-chord songs. Some of them are quite hard to do. But also, it's his phrasing. He sings like you're talking. He will, okay. You know, the notes aren't just bang, bang, bang on the beat. They're like bang, bang, ba-bang, bang, ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba, you know, like the way people talk. The world's a tumble out, kind of. And people that are noticed, take a listen to Jimi Hendrix. His phrasing is straight Bob Dylan, and he was the first to admit he was a huge Bob Dylan fan. Okay. Another guy is Mark Knopfler from Dire Straits.
Oh, yes.
Sultans of Swing. That's a straight Bob Dylan phrase song, you know, the way it's, you know. Anyway, that's an example of how Bob's songs have influenced everybody, you know.
Yeah.
And he's still around.
Yeah, yeah. Big switch from, what, acoustic to electric, and that caused a rift in the music industry.
Actually, that movie last year, I forget the name of it, it captures that era really well. Okay. I was a little bit too young. A friend of mine is like a couple of years older than me, and he was actually at that concert where he went electric. I think it was at the Newport Folk Festival. Anyway, I was just a little bit too young for that, but I was following the music, you know, because that was when I was learning guitar. Yeah, I like folk. Folk was huge back then. It was so huge, I think people got sick of it, and you couldn't sell folk for a while, and now it's people can listen to it again.
Yeah, I think, but with streaming and all, people get the choice of what they want to listen to, and so every genre now has not equal popularity, but certainly equal access.
Yeah, I like to listen to that stuff, and I was raised on country, I like folk, I even listen to classical and jazz, I like big band music when I'm painting. So I like all these types of music, and in recent years, I've really gotten an interest in how music intertwines, you know, how, you know, when I was young, I thought, oh, country music is story songs and three chords, whereas, you know, other types of rock and roll is more instrumental, but no, they all blended together. The blues weaves in and out, and, you know, so that's what I'm fascinated by these days.
Right. You know. Can you give me a quick recap of what's happening in Elmira?
Okay, my memory is horrible at my age.
This is your band concerts that you're putting on Sundays.
Yeah, these are, I remembered that much. Okay, who's playing? I think it's, the Honky Tonk Heart, female trio that's is playing next week, and they're really something to see. They're really personable. And I believe Naomi Bristow after that, who's the yodeling cowgirl, and she's amazing. And then I think Diane and the Cavaliers. And finally, it's a band called Southbound.
Right. That's Sunday nights.
Every Sunday night from 7 till 9 in Elmira at Gibson Park.
Right. We've got a few more weeks to catch up on that if you want to listen to some real genuine country music.
We got rained out yesterday, but we've had beautiful weather every other week this year, so we'll see what it'll be in the next few weeks.
Probably a good chance to get some nice hot weather still, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can you play me out, Lance? A little bit of that Travis finger picking. And then I will talk over your music to tell people that they've been listening to CKMS Community Connections for the 3rd of August, 2026. Had in the studio Lance Russworm, musician, artist, brother-in-law. Thank you for coming in, Lance.
Thank you.
CKMS Community Connections is a production of Radio Waterloo, is produced by Radio Waterloo, sponsored by Radio Waterloo. We air every Monday at 3 p.m., usually, our theme music is by Stephen Todd. Today, Lance Russmer is playing us out. I'll be back next week.